Okay, the Book of Mormon. Remember we talked about, at different times about doctrine. The Book of Mormon itself actually covered no doctrine. The doctrine comes along in the Doctrines and Covenants and subsequent revelation. And yet when a Mormon shows up at your door, you guarantee he's going to show up with the Book of Mormon and want you to read it. So just be aware, though, the real doctrines that they practice, a lot of them, I mean, there's some implied, but a lot of their doctrines were not clarified and formulated by the DMC, the 130 plus that Joseph Smith had. Those were all revelations, and then subsequently the other so-called prophets. The Book of Mormon itself, we had left off last Sunday talking about the Jaredites in this first migration and how they came across in 8 barges, with the barges each had a hole in the top and in the bottom, driven by the wind. They all showed up on the shore of South America at the same time and unloaded the people. And they brought with them animals in the barges as well. And this was in the 2200. This was the entire Babel, or Babel, however you prefer, about that time by Mormon reckoning. They settled in Central America after they had landed, and they had this fellow Jared and his brother that were the leaders of the organization, or these people. And they built a civilization, and it went on for a couple thousand years, and then they started having all kinds of internal conflicts, started having battles. They couldn't get along with one another, and they had some pretty big battles. One battle, they lost 2 million people were killed in one battle. And it was so furious of a war that at the end of it, there were only 2 men left. And one of them was named Coriantumr, and the other one was Shiz. And in the final battle, Shiz was killed. And so you got this other guy, and he's badly injured. So that's, and there was one other person, that's Ether, who's one of their historians at this period of time, or prophets, I should call them, who recorded the history during this period. Then in 600 BC, there's another migration of Jews. Of course, this would have been around the time of Babylonian captivity, so that's the association of the date. And so out of that migration, there was a prophet named Lehi, and his friend Ishmael came over, and some of their people came over, migrated over. Again, they migrated to the South America, Central America area. Lehi had 4 sons. 2 of them were Laman and Lemuel, and they were the bad guys. They were the bad kids. And they, as a result of their behavior, they were cursed by God. And so these two boys, their descendants, would be carrying this curse, and the curse was red skin. So they are the fathers of the Indian race, according to Mormon history, in the Book of Mormon. He had 2 other sons, one of which was named Nephi, and the leadership fell to Nephi, and they ended up calling themselves Nephites. And so they were the good brothers. Then there was a third Jewish migration, same time frame, 600 B.C., and in that migration there was the son of Zedekiah, and his name was Mulek, M-U-L-E-K, but after they all got together, things didn't go too well again, And so you're going to have more battles. And there was a sharp division within the population. And now there's two warring factions, Nephites and Lamanites. And the Nephites were faithful to the church. The Lamanites were apostates. And, their story. They were rebellious. And so they had ongoing disagreements and battles and that kind of thing. And then in 34 A.D., Christ came to visit them. And when he came, he settled them, told them about how he'd been crucified, and this is after his resurrection, and he comes and explains what he's done, and he brings peace among them. And so there's a period of time where everybody is at peace. Okay? I don't know how long, it wasn't very long after that, that they have another war. War breaks out again. And this is again between the Nephites and the Lamanites. And the Lamanites, in this case, chase the Nephites to North America. And again, millions are killed on both sides. So these are big, long, well, not that long, but big wars. And they ended up gathering for one, what was called one final battle in western New York, near the Hill Cumorah in A.D. 385. Now, Hill Cumorah, remember we introduced that earlier, and that's associated, what become associated with the Golden Plates. It's near where Joseph Smith lived. That's the Cumorah area. Well, the Lamanites won, and they only allowed a handful of Nephites to survive, including Mormon's son, Moroni. So Moroni lived. And the Lamanites were so bad, so evil, that they began fighting among themselves. I guess they've eliminated enough Nephites to have time to fight. And by the time Columbus found them in 1492, you can believe he found them, they were now Indians. And they recognized nothing about, had no knowledge of their Jewish history, how they migrated from Palestine. And they were what was called a filthy and loathsome people by Book of Mormon, Mormon 15. And again, their color, their skin, because of the kind of people they were, they'd been cursed. So that's a very short summation of the Book of Mormon for you. It is really in the eyes of a Mormon, I say in the eyes, I think they present it this way, it's a history of the migration of the Jews to the New World, and ultimately leading to what would be the revelation that came along, or the guidance that would come along because of the angel Moroni showing up to presenting himself to Smith.
Do they try to point to any sort of historical data outside of the Book of Mormon to show this?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yes. Unsuccessfully, but we'll get to it. Okay, so at the time of the writing, they claim this book was complete, 421 A.D., buried in the Hill of Cumorah, until Moroni told Smith about it. And, you know, their view was the history of, they claimed, the history of ancient America would have been lost if it wasn't for these faithful historians like Mormon, who wrote down on these metal plates an abridged version, which these metal plates were gold, six of them. So they remained, he wrote all that stuff down and remained buried for 1,400 years. And that brings us to the time frame that we started with, and that is with the vision of Joseph Smith in 1820. They're written in, supposedly written in, reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, which I've mentioned before. I want you to notice A, come back to it in a bit. Says that none other people knoweth our language, therefore he hath prepared means for interpretation thereof. Remember, I've made the point several times that the Mormon view, the Book of Mormon, not only being inspired as far as the content of it, but being inspired as far as the actual writing it down, interpretation of it out of this Reformed Egyptian into English. Okay? So that's it. Unlike manuscripts that we have in our possession about the Bible, regarding the Bible, since we don't have the originals, we have copies. And so the original manuscripts, of course, were inspired by God. And what got written down, no doubt, was what God wanted written down. But we don't have that. We have copies that have been made. Their claim, of course, they don't have their original either. They have manuscripts, and they really only have one primary manuscript that's readable. It's in good shape. But that is the result of the interpretation by Joseph Smith, as made possible and made right and correct by God, in this case. Okay. At the time that this was all going on, no one knew how to read Egyptian hieroglyphics. They didn't know how to read it. It predates the work that would be done in Egypt, and follow-ups that would come along in terms of language development, ancient language development, understanding what those ancient languages meant. And in a way, that's why this quote I gave you out of Mormon 9:34 will get to be significant in terms of some of the evaluations made. I don't think I need to go over the means of discovery. We talked about that, and we talked about Joseph Smith. I did want to make one comment. If you notice under 3, I said 4 years later he receives the plates. That's in 1827. And they were reported to be, and this is Talmage, the fellow that wrote, in fact, it's referenced the Articles of Faith, but he's the one that summed up the 13 Articles of Faith. He reported that the book was about 7 inches wide, 8 inches long, and the book thickness made up out of the plates was about 6 inches. Remember, these are gold plates. If you do the math, you have a book that weighed about 230 pounds. And the witnesses claim that we have seen and hefted, at 230 pounds, it would be a mighty heft of these books. Interestingly enough, Joseph Smith's mother claimed that he put the plates under one arm and carried them 3 miles, fighting off the attacks of 3 robbers at the same time. So there's a credible witness for you. They don't make men like they used to make them. And of course, he translated by this seer stone behind the veil. Sometimes it was, the thing with the plates wouldn't even be visible. Sometimes they weren't even in the same room. But he translated them nonetheless. This fellow Martin Harris, when we talked about scribes, there were 4 scribes, at least 4 I'm aware of, that as Smith would say, this is what's being communicated in English as he translated these things. These 4 scribes over a period of time would be writing them down, and one of them was Martin Harris. And he ended up, he had 116 pages of the Book of Mormon, and he managed somehow to lose it, so he had to go back and start all over again. And as a result of that, Smith had a what was called a printer's copy scribe, in which case it was a very clear, meticulous copy they made, manuscript they made in England, which they could then take to the printer and have a printer print it up, print up the book. And that has been preserved, that manuscript been preserved. There were two things, and we'll get to these witnesses a little bit later, but these plates were witnessed by these two groups. In fact, when you look in the Book of Mormon, that I gave you an appendix, and that's straight out of the Book of Mormon. Which is, I want to go over that just one second, which is interesting, because if you go back to Appendix 7, if you look at the testimony of three witnesses, everybody ready?
Page number
148. 148. It's all the way in the back. And if you didn't get it, it's probably because you weren't here.
I didn't get one.
Probably because you weren't here.
Let me see if I've got it. I've got stacks of a lot of things. I'm not sure I got stacks of those.
Yeah. I got some. I don't think I got all those. No. Ah. Just so happens to be have that one. Does anybody else not have it?
Thank you.
I did hand out all these appendices, right, at one time? Have y'all got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? No. Okay, I just handed out this one. That was the one I want to talk about. Okay, I got a plan. All right, look at the bottom. Look at the, there are three witnesses, excuse me, the first paragraph. Look at the last sentence. And the honor be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Ghost, which is one God. How many gods do the Mormons believe in today?
A lot more than one.
A lot more than one. Many, many gods. But at the time of the Book of Mormon witnesses, they looked at these three beings as one God. So anyway, there's the three. You can see the testimonies, their whole testimony. This is, like I say, this is straight out of the Book of Mormon. If you have a Book of Mormon, you find it. I just want to draw your attention back on the lesson now. It says, an angel of God came down from heaven, he brought and laid before our eyes that we beheld and saw the plates and the engravings thereon. And the witness, the group of eight witnesses, they Smith showed us the plate. Plates. We saw the engravings thereon. However, it wasn't all as reported there. And you know, today the Mormons will tell you that none of these men, even though there are some of them that either were excommunicated or apostatized, that none of them ever denied the Book of Mormon, what they said as witnesses relative to the Book of Mormon. There's a fellow named Curtis Carr, wrote a book called Mormonism, Let's End the Test. Makes this comment. I was given a book by a Mormon official and told it was used in a religion class at Brigham Young University. It was called a student manual and stated it was prepared for the church education system. In this manual, there's a section entitled The Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. Under the three witnesses, it said none of them ever denied the testimony. Under the eight witnesses, it says that Christian Whitmer, Peter Whitmer, Joseph Smith Sr., Hiram Smith, and Samuel Smith were always faithful members of the church. It says that although Jacob Whitmer, John Whitmer, and Hiram Page were either excommunicated or apostatized, none of them ever denied their testimony. Now, in your notes, you'll see Journal of Discourses, Mormon document. If some of the witnesses of the Book of Mormon who handled the place and traversed with angels of God were afterwards left to doubt and to disbelieve that they had ever seen an angel. Two, you see where I've highlighted it, talking about the presidency, several of the 12 apostles, president of the 70s, the witnesses of the Book of Mormon, and a number of others standing high standing in the church were all carried away in this apostasy of going to renounce the Book of Mormon, as well as Joseph Smith. You have Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Lyman Johnson. I don't know who he is, but the first two are, I don't think Lyman was a witness. The first two are witnesses. And they, as is stated there, they openly renounce this. There is a another that's come out of Harris, and I'll read it to you in a second. Smith had Martin Harris take some of this, these characters, Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, and take it over to these two guys, a Professor Anton and a Dr. Mitchell, and they wanted them to validate that these in fact were interpreted right, even wrote it down in English, it was translated right. And so Martin goes off to see Professor Anton. I really don't know much about Mitchell. And he presents these characters and the translation to the professor, who stated that the translation was correct, more so than he had before seen translated from the Egyptian. Martin further reported that Anthon identified the characters as Egyptian, Chaldaic, Syriac, and Arabic. And he said they were true characters. And then Martin claims he got a certificate certifying people to the people of Palmyra that they were true characters. Martin did go see Anthon. Here's what Anthon said. He sent a couple of letters concerning the visit. In each letter, Anthon denies that he had told Harris that the characters were legitimate. In addition to that, he reported that Anthon said that the translation was correct, but Anthon, with all his brilliance and training, could not have determined the accuracy of the translation. This point I made earlier, in 1828, no one in the world had seen this translated from Egyptian. And this is a different Egyptian. And a guy by the name of Kimball made a comment. He said, even a reincarnated Egyptian could not have translated the characters because the reformed Egyptian had been so changed that none of the other people knew our language. And I thought that's what I was telling you a while ago. So here he is, you got a guy that doesn't really, I mean, I don't know how to read Egyptian, so it's so silly to take this to him and claim that he's able to say it's accurate, understand it's accurate, they didn't know how to read it. This is his professor didn't. And at the same time, no one could read it based on what their own book said. So it's kind of a catch-22 for them. Anthon also wrote about it, called The Gold Plate Story of Hoax. The intent was to cheat Harris out of his money. And so that's sort of and I think you'll probably, if you ran into a Mormon that really had the background, you probably hear from them that this thing was authenticated, but that's not true. It was not based on the records that are public records.
So where do they get the characters from?
Probably imagination.
The plates are gone. Gold plates had it written down in.
Well, Smith, at this time, Smith provided the characters. He wrote
Smith,
down a piece
so
of paper.
So Smith made a copy on paper
of the characters and the translation thereof.
Why didn't he just steal one of those plates out of there? It's not like he's going to do something wrong.
Steal something that doesn't exist. According to Smith, translation was verified by the Lord's voice in June of 1829. And it says, these plates have been revealed and translated by the power of God. The translation of them which you have seen is correct. So, you've got the manuscript nobody can read, but God, was dismissed and never interpreted, and God has provided the guidance for that true interpretation. Okay? That's their view. He did keep, the Smith took all of the original manuscripts that he had, other than the printer's manuscript, and put it into the house they built, Nauvoo, Illinois, that house. Sometime later, in the early 1900s, they were remodeling in some way, and they found the manuscripts. But the manuscripts are now in the property, are now the property of the LDS, and only a few very limited, they were in bad shape to begin with, but only a few very limited ones have been photocopied for other people to see. The printers, they own the printer's manuscript too, but it has been 100% photocopied and it's freely available. So that's their manuscript history. And then I show you the history of the printings and kind of what changed with the printings as far as, notes and things of that nature and the versions they've since produced. There's some obvious internal problems. Any questions about that? No, I'm going through that kind of quick. Okay. There's some internal problems with the book. There's a lot of plagiarism. And these are easy to demonstrate. I mean, I've read material on it, I've seen the demonstration of it in a number of cases. No sense boring you with that. You can find, and I'll give you some examples a little bit later on, that there are whole sections that are just copied over or modified ever so slightly and basically copied out of the King James Version of the Bible. There was also a book called Ethan Smith's View of Hebrews, written in 1823, you can find things in the Book of Mormon. Remember, the Book of Mormon was finished in 421 A.D. Don't lose sight of that date, or at least that general date. And this book was written in 1823, and yet you find things in the Book of Mormon that are evidence of plagiarism from that book. Likewise, from the King James Bible. There are different estimates made, 17,000 to 27,000 words from the King James Bible are found in the Book of Mormon. Now, it's not talking about thee and, go count words. He's talking about words involved in phrases like I've shown you in the material. There are, if you think about it for a minute, here's a book that was written, being written in 400 A.D. King James Bible was not completed until early 1600s, 1611. And why on earth would so-called people, Mormon, who wrote this book, parts of it, what would he be doing having the same language, the same words, as the King James Bible? I mean, it just defies any kind of logic other than, actually what happened is Joseph Smith copied parts of the Bible. The Book of Mormon even has some of the same translation errors that you'll find in the King James Bible. Remember, the King James Bible has it's an excellent document, but it has a limited amount there was limitations in terms of the textual material we have today, and there was limitations in terms of some of the languages. The easiest one I came across to explain is if you look at the 1611 King James Version, you'll find that. Everybody know what a cherub is? Angel? You know how many? What do you call more than one cherub? Cherubim. You don't call them cherubs. You don't call them cherubims. The Hebrew language, the E-M on the end, is the plural. So you talk about more than one angel, more than one cherub, it's cherubim. So I am. But what the New King James Version does is it puts an S on it. It calls them cherubims. Well, guess what? The Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon made the same error. It's copied cherubims. And so you can see those kinds of things that are obvious. God would know what Hebrew was. And so if he's going to translate into English the plural of that word, you know how to do it.
Maybe with their version of what God is, just an exalted man, he's really going to make stuff errors like that.
I don't think they'd say that.
They won't?
I don't think so.
No.
He asked about, I'm going to call it archaeology, just things you can take out of the Book of Mormon and find these things that have been talked about. Can you find them? And this is a problem. The Mormon missionaries will claim the Book of Mormon is validated, or rephrase that. Discoveries validate the Book of Mormon being accurate. And I'll talk about that a little more in a minute. Okay. Anything about those, I want to hit, we'll hit plagiarisms and, some specifics, archaeology, some specifics in a moment if we get to it. Anything about what we covered on that so far?
They would say that it was just a conspiracy. This professor denying, and sending it to the newspaper. But they just say that it was just a conspiracy against the Mormon Church at the time.
I don't know what they say. Mm. I mean, they would defend it, I'm sure. Somehow, they tried to discredit it. But, what you do on these kind of things, it's just like you're gathering evidence. People gather evidence. I don't have access to, I don't think any of you do, have access to the 1830 Book of Mormon, which we're going to look at in a lesson. I'm having to rely on people who I can read today that had access from, I don't know where they get out of Library of Congress, went to the Mormon Library, I'm not sure where they got it from, but they had access to the 1830 Book of Mormon. And these things change. I think used to, I may be wrong about this, some of you know Jim Swan. When Jim Swan was preaching, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Jim had found someplace, Book of Mormon, 1830, or it may have been 1840. It may have been 1840. But it was a very early, not the current version. And he kept it in his library just to be able to make these kinds of comparisons if he ever had to. Okay. Talk about the Book of Mormon versus the Bible. Of course, the Book of Mormon, we talked about this, claims to be inspired of God. And both from the standpoint of being the Word of God and being translation. You see that in your notes. It claims it contains the fullness of the gospel. Interestingly enough, if you look in the front of the Book of Mormon, it says another testament of Jesus Christ. I think that's the way it's worded. It's another testament. DNC 27 calls the Book of Mormon contains the fullness of my everlasting gospel. Then DNC 42 says the Bible and the Book of Mormon, which is the fullness of the gospel. Well, which is it? Is it the Book of Mormon, or is it the Book of Mormon plus the Bible that makes the four? And so it's just some more of that running into itself. And one thing it says it's another testament. And it clearly is not a repeat of what we know as the New Testament. It doesn't have any relationship to that. So, you know, they make these claims, as we talked before, when you've got a man making claims instead of actually having the Holy Spirit be the one, God providing the continuity and the harmony and the consistency and not lying. You have men do that instead, they're going to run into one another. And it's been clear in watching Joseph Smith. The Bible, some of these we've covered. What did Jesus promise the apostles?
All the truth.
Guide you into all the truth. So is there anything, is there need for anything more than, is there need for another gospel? See, there is no need. If you believe the Bible, believe Jesus. Did Paul leave anything out in his preaching in Ephesus?
No.
No. Whole purpose of God. What did Peter confirm in 2 Peter 1?
It's all things.
You give everything.
True knowledge.
Okay. And so you've got, you know, you got the apostles that keep repeating. Jesus said it, the apostles repeat it. What did Jude say? We're all familiar with it.
Contend for the
faith. Once for all delivered.
Once for all. All for all people?
Once
for all time delivered. And there wasn't a need to have another one, and yet that's what the Mormons would claim. The Book of Mormon, I made this, we talked about this. Here are some examples. Now remember, this was written, all written prior to 33 AD, all written prior to 1611. Let me restate that. That is, what was that? I'm not sure why I made that statement. Let me think about it. No, I'm going to take that example. I don't know what I had in mind written prior to 33 AD. These things are written, the Book of Mormon is written in 400 AD or finished in 400 AD. Unless there's something about, I don't, there may be something about the timing of this, and I don't remember if that's what it is. That the timing of these things in the book itself, the Book of Mormon, may associate with writings before 1833, but don't quote me on that. Nonetheless, you can look at King James Version of the Bible, Book of Mormon, and you just see them, you just track them. And this is just, these are just examples, some of the examples. The whole book of, what is it, 15 chapters, whatever it is, 13 chapters of Isaiah are repeated in Nephi, word for word, essentially word for word. There is, you know, it's interesting that here it is, Joseph Smith, in the 1800s, America in the 1800s did not speak the King's English. These and thous and ye's was King's English of the 1600s. Now, I'm not even sure the Englishman spoke this way in the 1800s. But America didn't. And yet that's the terminology found throughout the Book of Mormon. And we're talking about people before 1600, back in the 400 AD, and previously, certainly didn't speak these and thous. But he's translating into, supposedly into English of the Americas. But he's not translating, he's copying. You see that in the use of these terms. D&C is written the same way. You have italicized words in the King James Version, as we know, words that were added for understanding, you find the same thing in the Book of Mormon. that are italicized for whatever reason. I guess because Joseph Smith didn't know the meaning of the italicized, why it was italicized. Why do you think he did? Why do this? I mean, it just seems stupid. You're trying to make a book prudent, prove you got a book that goes back to 400 and earlier. Why did you do this? This is speculation. You're free to speculate.
He's a bad dreamer.
Maybe he's lazy. He doesn't want to be more creative. He just make copies.
I wonder if he expected that everything would kind of take off. Like, if he really expected that a lot of people would follow him and buy into this craziness.
I don't know. I wonder if he's, using things like ye and specifically using things like ye and thee and thou. If you read the Book of Mormon, if you're used to reading the King James Version, start with that. When you read the Book of Mormon, it sounds biblical.
And two,
it's
the apostasies
kind of
that were going on the 400s. I mean, he's going back and he's picking up on something that was happening supposedly during all those times. You know, the truth was being aligned, and the elders and the bishops and all this kind of stuff on the 400. And he's going to say, hey, you know, I've got the truth coming out of the 1400s.
Well, the trouble is the 400, when you talk about the 400s, the Book of Mormon itself is just a history book. It just has nothing to do with what they would later claim is the abominable church, i.e. the Catholic Church, doing things to the Bible. I mean, they're not related in that way. I don't know why I did it. Greek, but you find things like Greek, baptism. Baptism came around. It would have been immersion in this time. We're going to talk about the word baptism. It would have been immersion before King James. King James, when they translated, was that transliterated? Baptismal made baptism. Because they didn't want to talk about immersion, because they didn't practice it. That was the problem. In King James time.
Well, your point about the italicized words of the King James, that's a pretty significant argument. Right? So they claim that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. Well, those italicized words are not the words of God. The words of men put in there in 1611 or past that.
Yeah.
Not part of God's Word.
Right.
And it was written 1,400 years earlier. Right?
It doesn't compute. It always is that a quotation from Hamlet? Okay.
You look these things up. Knew about it and did that.
Well, they will argue. I mean, people have time. They'll figure out how they want to defend these things and what they'll try to argue that the Book of Mormon, in terms of the Old Testament connections at least, say the same thing. Of course, content-wise, it doesn't explain the yeats and the thees and the thous, because they're applicable. That those words coming from God, and they admit God. I mean, they contend God inspired Old Testament and the King James Bible, as far as it's translated correctly, it's representative of God's inspired word. So they try to make that connection. You're trying to say it's copy. We're just trying to say same God provided it. And we talked about no original language. Okay, we will do class. All right, we're going to get, unless something happens strange, we will get through with Book of Mormon Sunday in our makeup class. So, this one right here, your final test, we'll spend 5 minutes just talking, 10 minutes talking through this. I hope you kept notes for yourself. Now, you're going to teach them more. And then we're, if we got time, we'll get into Jehovah's Witnesses. So you can start that lesson. All right? Thank you.